What have we learned? What have we learned in the 6 years since Christchurch and the far-right fanatic who live-streamed his own mass shooting in a New Zealand mosque? Here in France, outrage over the 53-year-old who posted 5 times to Facebook before and after killing his Tunisian neighbor, and who also targeted 2 Kurdish asylum seekers. Posts included a call to, quote, go get them wherever they are. Use of disparaging language to denote Arabs, and to vote for Marine Le Pen's national rally, enough for it to be treated as a terror case, and for the conservative right interior minister to make the trip to the French Riviera town of Puget-sur-Argence. How much of the blame for the real-life attack goes to the virtual world, as U.S. tech platforms downsize fact-checking and content moderation on their sites? The European Union finds itself in a bind. Its Digital Services Act needs enforcement and reinforcement, say anti-racism advocates. But it's also locked in a wide-ranging trade negotiation with the United States, whose vice president clearly states that Europe's biggest challenge is the threat within of assault on free speech and censorship of MAGA world ideas. Does Europe have what it takes to define and defend the free exchange of ideas while preventing the phones in our pockets from becoming bullhorns for hate? Today in the France 24 debate, should we be blaming social media? With us is Iris Boyer, senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Thank you for joining us here on France 24.
Thank you for having me.
From the Brittany city of Rennes in western France, sociologist Dominique Bouillet, professor of sociology at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Damien Lecomte, political science researcher at Paris Panthéon Sorbonne University. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
On the go, you can listen to the show wherever podcasts are streamed. That's a little reminder. Let's start with the latest. The suspect in last Saturday's shooting death of 45-year-old neighbor Hichem Mirawi confessing to murdering the Tunisian barber before an investigating magistrate this Thursday, but denying a racist motive. That's not how eyewitnesses see it. Antonia Kerrigan has more.
Days after his shooting, it emerges that 45-year-old Hichem Mirawi was subjected to a long and persistent campaign of xenophobic harassment by his next-door neighbour, a campaign well known in the town where they both lived.
Not only did he kill him, but a lot of other things happened before that too. He would shout insults at him when he came home, vandalise his scooter and shout at him in the hallway every time he smelled food.
His sister said that just weeks before the attack, he had found his Vespa graffitied with the words filthy Arab, and that the neighbour in question, Christophe B, was well known in the neighbourhood for his racist views.
Monsieur qui a tué Hichem.
The man who killed Hichem posted hateful comments about the Muslim world on social media. They lived next door, but he hated that the Muslim world was different.
At a time when the hard-right national rally is the largest party in the National Assembly and anti-immigration hardliners occupy high-level ministries in government, immigration has been put at the very centre of political debate, a fixation which critics say has loosened taboos on racism. On Tuesday, the Socialist Party leader laid some of the blame with the Prime Minister and his Interior Minister.
Unfortunately, they themselves have contributed to fostering an atmosphere of suspicion towards foreigners or French citizens perceived as foreigners. They are not responsible for the crime that was committed, but they do bear responsibility for the climate that, regrettably, surrounds public debate in France today.
Christophe B posted on social media both before and after the shooting, claiming responsibility for the attack and issuing a call to arms against North Africans. The NGO SOS Racism said the morning after the shooting that this crime must serve as a reminder to political office holders to be responsible in what they say.
And by the way, we're also joined from the southern city of Avignon by Étienne Drouard, lawyer at the law firm Hogan Lovell, specializing in personal data protection and cybersecurity. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me begin with Iris Boyer. This is, as we heard, that clip of a neighbor talk about this is a murder where there were signals, both offline and online. Your thoughts on whether or not this could have been prevented?
Yes, thank you. I think, like, the first striking issue is really how did we end up in such a collective failure? You put it in your introduction. We have seen it happen over and over again. You named Christchurch. There were similar events happening in London over the past years and in different countries. And for some reason I cannot explain, and I dare to say it because I'm French, and we do like a bit of self-beating. We still think we are special and this will not happen here somehow. I think what's really problematic is this impression that we can have double standards, starting by really naming what it is, a racist motivated attack, and saying that it's essentially equals, you know, it's very similar in its methodology as what we've been calling terrorism for over a decade now with Islamist extremism. Here we have the same. It's basically an ideologically motivated hate crime. So starting by calling a cat, I think is is already a step forward. But I think where really we are missing the point is if we try to apply some blanket solutions that are only tackling the tip of the iceberg. And for instance, content moderation is indeed crucial, but it cannot address the root causes of polarization. And again, whether it's government, whether it's the expert community, and I take responsibility also being a part of it, whether it's companies, you know, their responsibility is to prevent it. So the researchers have been tracking it, have been saying that there is a problem of far-right extremism. We've been documenting it over and over again from, you know, the time when something like the Great Replacement was just a very niche concept, and now it has become so mainstream that in France we even have a full mainstream expression, you know, saying great replace someone that the far right has been using. And now it's on mainstream media all the time.
Yeah, so the Great Replacement, just for our viewers, is the idea that people in Europe are being replaced by immigrants, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And so I think putting it under the carpet, this threat of racist extremism or whatever you want to call it, far-right extremism, for years, and calling it differently has not been helpful because it reinforces this double standard, which will increase mistrust. And what we know is that, you know, at the extreme side of the spectrum, if you take you know, Islamist extremism and far-right extremism, this is a phenomenon called cumulative extremism. Both of them feed one another. Their agenda, their communication methodology, their communication agenda is set by one another, and they respond to one another. So it's about time we treat them and we enforce laws in a similar fashion. And it's about time we recognize also the broader responsibility that mainstream media, not only you know, tech companies, but it's a continuum between right. Online platforms and, for instance, 24 hours mainstream media. I'm not putting the blame on you, but there are some channels who have you know, an editorial line that focuses only on these ideas that reinforce the far right narratives, and this plays into this.
Yes, yeah, so let's pick up on this concept of cumulative extremism. What is radical and what has become mainstream? Case in point, the Interior Minister, who has presidential ambitions, he's just been elected, by the way, head of the conservative Les Républicains party, Bruno Retailleau, who triggered a fury over the weekend with a tweet that those who committed acts of vandalism during Paris Saint-Germain's Champions League celebrations in Paris are barbarians. And the use of the term barbarians, again, seen as sort of making mainstream racist language. Dominique Bouillet, is it shocking for the Interior Minister to call those who did commit misdemeanors, who did break things? There were fatalities due to two of them in France during the celebration night. Are they, you know, this use of the word barbarians? Your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's the problem will be for the next events, and those murders are clearly like on a very different stage, different level of crime. What kind of term can you use? You know, is using and making this kind of vocabulary completely obsolete, and just by trying to put
Dominique Bouillet, sorry, I'm gonna have to interrupt you, unfortunately, because we're having a sound issue. We're going to try to fix that as quickly as possible. Damien Lecomte, your thoughts on this issue. You know, again, and by the way, before I turn to you, the same interior minister employs the term barbarians. Fairness to him, he does go all the way down to Puget-sur-Argent there, that suburb of the Riviera city of Fréjus, where he denounced this as a hate crime. And said so before Parliament. Let's take a listen.
This crime was premeditated and it bears a clear sign. It was premeditated because there were videos and we seized weapons in the car. But above all, it bears a clear sign. It's clearly a racist crime. It's also undoubtedly an anti-Muslim crime and perhaps even a terrorist once, since the CNAT has been alerted.
The CNAT, the National Counter-Terrorism Unit of the French judiciary. So there we hear an unequivocal denouncing of this as a suspected terror attack, as Iris Boyer called for at the outset here. But then again, there's that use of the word barbarians. In a different context, about a different incident.
Yes, indeed. It can be argued that Bruno Retailleau has his share of responsibility in the rise of some xenophobic or racist ideas, because he, as a conservative leader, he has been following and maybe amplifying a strategy that was one of Nicolas Sarkozy when he was president, that is to compete with the far right by somehow show some complacency with the xenophobic and nationalist ideas. And so we have heard Bruno Retailleau in the past having very strong word against immigration, against Muslims. And so, yes, now in front of this crime, he has used some strong words to denounce racism and hate crimes. But in the past, he has been much more ambivalent in the denunciation of racism and Islamophobia.
Again, the question is, in the case of what happened in that town in the south of France, the suspect had posted five times to Facebook, including one time where he talked about, quote, go get them wherever they are. Exactly what is the responsibility of a social medium like Facebook in this specific case here?
Well, it's quite simple, actually, in a sense. When content is directly inciting violence and breaking both the platform's own rules but existing governmental rules or supra-governmental, like European rules, this should be removed. And the problem is that with, you know, in recent times, we have been seeing a different approach by tech companies. Basically, what's more of a laxist approach, if you take Facebook compared to some years where they were more interventionist. Now we are sort of caught up in this momentum where it feels like they are not, it's my own interpretation only, but they are not being so interventionist, also linked with recent developments in the US and the new doctrine, so to speak. And they are sort of waiting for the big enforcement of the DSA. So really, the idea is like, I mean, the question and the challenge is really, will we be able to enforce this Digital Services Act.
Yeah.
Because whatever is not being enforced on a timely manner does have real-world consequences. We've seen it actually in the past with things like Christchurch and the live video, but really I think the problem, and that's what makes us lose a lot of precious time, is the different setup of each companies and the different rules and the lack of interoperability. Because if we had put a while back a system like we did, for instance, for the prevention of child abuse or for, Islamist terrorism with the hashing system that's shared across companies, for instance, this would be much easier. But now we are seeing people who have been sharing and reading and commenting with very incendiary comments for years and years and years. We know that the websites they were consulting and they were sharing and amplifying on social media were highly problematic, but we are just looking at it, completely passive. So absolutely, tech platforms have a responsibility to enforce their rules and to prevent incendiary content from being spread and from being amplified.
Okay.
That's the main issue.
Etienne Drouard is back with us. Apologies for those technical issues, Etienne.
Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. When it comes to Puget sur Argent and to that hate crime, should Facebook be taken to court?
In the specific circumstance, there is no pattern of communication that could be tagged with a fingerprint shared between platforms, because in this specific case, the visibility of the signal, even 4 to 5 times from one individual, could not be caught from a pattern supervision mechanism. Then there is an obligation to detect and to offer users to set up an alert when such hate speech content is published. In this specific circumstance, let's just have an idea of the volume we are talking about the numbers of messages that are posted on social networks from France. It's 1 billion per minute. 1 billion per minute. So I would be very interesting in case of an investigation, and why not a prosecution, to clearly determine whether there is an obligation for platforms to be so focused on any single word or video that is published that at some point they could have the level of efficiency we expect from them in this kind of circumstances. But I think there is a difference between the regulatory regime, which requires quick reaction, blocking, interpretation of the content, which is much more, much easier to perform with childhood pornography than with the hate speech. I'm not saying that an individual, a human being analyzing these videos would not consider this is hate speech. Everybody could consider this is hate speech. But how fast can you dedicate someone to view the video, make a decision, and delete the video from a social network with this level and amount of publishing actions every minute? So in this specific circumstance, in case there would be a litigation, regardless of the consequences of this situation in the real life, I'm not sure any infringement could be raised against the social network.
No infringement could be raised. And what about this European Union Digital Services Act? Does it make the case that there is a responsibility on the part of the big platforms when it comes to hate speech?
Yeah, exactly. There is a responsibility of blocking any obvious illegal content or harmful content. Hate speech is the most difficult one to interpret. And the obligation is to implement mechanisms, automated plus human verification, that are sufficiently reactive to fulfill the fast reaction requirement from the DSA.
Let me just interrupt you on that point, Etienne, because in the news this very week is a different case, and I'm just going to find out from you whether you think this passes the smell test for hate speech. On Wednesday at Paris Central Courts, the prosecution asking for sentences going as high as 4 months behind bars for 13 members of a small far-right group calling itself Les Natifs, the Natives, which in March of last year posted a photo to social media to protest the choice of Franco-Malian hip-hop star Aya Nakamura to perform at the opening ceremony of the Olympics. The post was seen 4.5 million times, stating, quote, "This is Paris, not Bamako Market." Bamako, the capital of Mali. The Twitter account of Les Natifs, Etienne Douai, when we checked it earlier, is still online and active. An account at the time which regretted the Africanization of our popular song and the pushing out of people of this land in favor of outer European immigration. And you can see on top of the banner there, the picture, saying, Frenchmen, wake up. And talking about two cases in which the far right has talked about, and one in which a student in Paris was murdered by a Moroccan immigrant, and the other where a young man in the south of France tried to intervene in a fight between rival gangs who were of foreign origin. Let me ask you, Etienne Drouard, should that Twitter account which states on its banner, "Frenchmen, wake up," should that be allowed to stay online?
This banner in itself could only be blocked after a judicial decision. The content that you've been describing has been declared unlawful after a judicial decision, after weeks and months of instruction. So there is a huge difference between the example that you describe, which result from the time for a judge to make a decision, and the almost real-time automated decision that the social network has to make about the qualification of a content. So you can prohibit and block a content, especially when you are a judge. It doesn't mean that the person displaying this consent should be banned from social networks forever, just for the banner you've been describing, which may be part of freedom of speech, even in France, regardless of what we say about freedom of speech in France. So this is where the analysis of any situation has to be taken on a case-by-case basis. And I'm always grateful for judges to do their job, but it takes time. But at the end of the day, you have a decision that nobody could challenge. Instead of asking a perfect filtering mechanism coming from social networks that would have to react 100% of times in any situation. And there would be also a question of freedom of speech. So the balance between immediate reaction or longstanding analysis from a court is exactly where we need to find which situation can be addressed efficiently by which kind of response plan.
Iris Boyer, do you agree that the case of that Twitter, or sorry, X account that we just saw with that banner, which is some would call it a dog whistle message, some would call it a blatant racist message, saying French people wake up, that is something only a judge can decide?
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a broader context. And I think basically this is textbook, the kind of tendency we have that I think is highly problematic. Whenever like a problematic event happens, we focus on one piece of content, on one piece of action, or or you know, the potential responsibility of one actor, in this case Facebook or X. And I think this is the problem, because you know, ultimately what we want to do is to improve the climate, because this, the climate creates this kind of situation and the repetition of this kind of actions. So if you want to improve the climate, you need to clean the environment. To clean the environment, you basically need to really look honestly at what social media is at the moment made of, and it includes a lot of highly problematic groups that are which content is algorithmically driven, and which you know, users and members are only fed the same kind of content, because this is how this, you know, the information ecosystem is actually structured via social media. Even mainstream media have had to adapt to this based on your taste, based on your own interests. So it's basically reinforced people's beliefs. And so I think that's where you need to start. Like, first, tackling, you know, the environment and cleaning it, because it's not just about whether Facebook is responsible for this man taking this action, even if he announced it on social media, you're never going to be able to play this whack-a-mole game with everyone. But the broader question is whether platforms like Facebook have a bigger responsibility in terms of, you know, structuring the way, you know, it's possible to make this environment about highly polarizing content. It's the same with online misogyny, leading to, you know, sexist hate crime, especially among youth. It's the same with the culture of cyber harassment. It's the same with a lot of phenomena. And I think if we focus only on pieces of content and whether they should be litigated in this sense or not, of course it should be done, but this is maybe... this is not what we should focus on in the aftermath, in the direct aftermath of such a tragedy.
A lot of these social media groups as you just pointed out, their business model is to find algorithms that will comfort people in their, reinforce their beliefs. And there is a mood music going on right now over in the United States. Donald Trump Wednesday evening giving a shout out to Europe and announcing a new travel ban on a whole host of countries.
We will not let what happened in Europe happen to America. That's why on my first day back in office, I directed the Secretary of State to perform a security review of high-risk regions and make recommendations for where restrictions should be imposed.
Damien Lecomte, we will not let happen in Europe. What happened in Europe happened in America. What is he talking about?
I'm not sure exactly what Donald Trump is talking about, but what I want to say is that the importance of far-right extremism in the social media is, of course, going hand in hand with the normalization of far-right extremism in public debate, in mainstream politics and mainstream media. What we have seen in the United States, obviously, with Trumpism, and it is also what we can see here in France with the strategies of the national rally to strategies of normalization and respectabilization. But this tragedy kind of reminds us that there is a contrast between these respectable face that the National Rally is showing and its electoral core, its electoral base, where you can still find a lot of white nationalist idea, white supremacist idea, these great replacement conspiracy theories that we have talked about. And so I think that it is also really a reflection of this rise of far-right extremism.
So here's the chicken and egg question. Is Donald Trump's brand of nationalism made possible by social media, or is social media's success made possible by the anything goes speech we're hearing from Washington?
I do think it goes both ways. I think that mainstream far-right feeds the extremism in social media, And conversely, it makes more easier for politicians to have some hate speech or at least dog whistles aimed at these electorates.
It goes both to the far right. It also goes to radical Islam. Etienne Drouin, there was recently a report that said that here in France that there's been radicalization of young people on TikTok to be Islamicized. And that was given a lot of coverage a couple of weeks ago.
Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear, Etienne Drouin.
Yeah, sorry. So here, the influence of the selection of content and the prioritization of content from algorithm is at stake, coming from targeting advertising to opinions content, at the end of the day, hate speech, and the recruitment of young people for violent action or terrorism. And the idea here is to combine the regulation of algorithms, the regulation of content moderation, in order to tackle those questions. It could be the example you gave, but also the influence on elections. And here, the tricky part for lawyers is to determine what is part of the feed of a content, what is the limit to the prioritization of content on some vulnerable people, especially youth? It's part of the DSA also to enforce it. And in France, the regulator is ARCOM, the regulator of communication and media. So the problem does exist. It is huge, but the articulation between the legislations and regulators to tackle it is not yet mature, because it's a mix between DSA, Digital Services Act, GDPR, Minors Protection, and also the Artificial Intelligence Act.
So let me ask you about this, because
we are not yet all set.
Let me ask you about this, because the European Union's Tech Sovereignty Commissioner, just this very day, unveiling the bloc's international digital strategy going forward, and as predicted by news outlet Politico, the plan sticks to, well, kind of vague promises to work with international partners to boost competitiveness, promote a rules-based global order. And there is this background music, of course, that there is right now serious trade tensions with the United States. Etienne Drouin, with so much of social media based in Silicon Valley, how far does the European Union go in enforcing the rules already on the book? You mentioned DSA and the GDPR rules that already exist, just at the time when the Trump administration wants Europe to loosen those rules.
The European Union has adopted its own legislation, so the framework is sufficiently complex, articulated, to be used now and clarified. It takes time for regulators to agree on how they can combine their respective actions. So now the debate, which has this trade warfare in background, about how we would regulate social platforms, is in the law. It has to be now executed and clarified. Exactly for what we are trying to do this evening, to know who is responsible and what are the limits. And I think so far that since we've been adopting 12 huge pillars of legislation on digital during the past 5 years in Europe, we should now apply them instead of communicating only. Apply them means enforce them through regulators that know exactly what is their scope of intervention and how they combine together. And let me tell you that this puzzle is not easy to understand even for specialists, because these regulators just take action from their respective roles. So it's a matter of time, it's a matter of efficiency, and legislators are very good to adopt rules, but then after, when you need to implement and enforce them, the real work starts.
Iris Boyer, if there was one area in which you would like to see more enforcement, where would it be? And whose job is it? Would it be Brussels' job or the 27 nations to enforce the rules of this Digital Services Act?
Great question. Perhaps just building on what was just said, I would say that, you know, we tend to be very pessimistic about our ability to compete with, US-based tech giants. And it's true, we in Europe, we may not have the tech giants, but we have this legal muscle, so to speak. And I think, you know, if we look at things like the GDPR enforcement, we made it happen. And actually, a lot of regions in the world are craving it, craving what we have, this acquis, as we say in French, that we have. So I think we need to be optimistic about that. And perhaps one of the the other solution or option is also to continue challenging these U.S. tech superpowers and their monopolies. Because if we create this competition, then they won't have so much leverage, and we have other leverage like markets. Fines and other regulatory measures to pressurize them. But something that I think really needs to be emphasized and focused on really meaningfully is also all the prevention measures, not only the litigation and the removal side of the enforcement. So I think Europe has to be much bolder in terms of enabling meaningful education on digital issues, not only digital, actually, on really how the information ecosystem restructuring is shaping our very democratic assets, basically, and making sure that the broader public understand what's at stake and what it means in their daily life, I think is the biggest challenge, because it's this education layer that if you don't have it, it then fuels all the issues we've been talking about before, the disenfranchisement and all the things leading to radicalization. I think really much more investment on education is definitely one of the key things to put in place.
Damien Leconte, education ministers in France, they come and go, especially these days. We've had a lot of government shakeups. But now they're talking about civics classes in schools, which they... your thoughts on how much they're grasping what Iris Boyer is talking about, you know, actually educating young people, and maybe older ones too, on, how algorithms work and what is... how do we get our information?
Well, it is true that the current education minister, for how long we don't know, but the current education minister, former Prime Minister Elizabeth Borne, has shown a willingness to educate more children to social media and to protect them from disinformation and from all the bad things that can happen when you are not prepared to use social media. So maybe we can expect the government to take some clever steps to protect children and to educate them.
Which has also been in the news. There's been several stabbing instances in middle and high schools which have shocked public opinion. Part of the reason why, said former Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne, now the Education Minister, announced on the radio this morning, cell phones will be banned from all public and middle schools next September.
Regarding the increase in violence, I'd prefer to talk about social networks, and that's why I'd like most notably to protect pupils from overexposure to screens with the trivialization of violence on social networks. It's a subject we need to tackle. That's why I've extended a digital pause for everyone. In other words, they put away their cell phones when they walk into their middle school.
Etienne Drouard, that direct link between screens and violence. Your thoughts?
My personal thoughts, I have no doubt this is true. As a lawyer, I would tell you that the adoption of a ban after 10 p.m. of a screen towards minors would not be easy to vote, especially with the parliament we have. But it has to be qualified. I would say if we take it for a communication issue or media issue, maybe it will take time. We won't have the right leverages. If we consider it as an education matter, this is partly true or not. If we start considering it's a matter of public health, maybe we could have the right leverages. But everything is to be built on this point. China has implemented some restriction, and this is a counterexample of democracy. However, they did it for not only for authoritarian activity, but also to prevent the harmful effects of an excessive exposure to screens. And what is excessive in a situation from another? Lots of works are starting on this point. 10 years ago, we didn't have the same exposure to as the one we have today. Algorithms were not as tribalizing as they are today, but adopting a rule like that requires, as Elizabeth Bourne did, to test the population, to work on it, to have some studies, researches that could demonstrate something, and also find the right path to adopt a legislation
on this issue.
Etienne Droit, as relating to health.
We're going to have to leave it there, but seeing it as a public health issue, the way forward. Thank you so much for joining us from Avignon. I want to thank Iris Boyer for being with us as well. Damien Lecomte, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.